So I have the privilege of introducing Bruce Hammack, our speaker today. I told him it'd be short and sweet, but maybe more sweet than short here. I have a few things I'd like to say about him. You know, one of the great privileges of living in the basement or residing there is I've gotten to know Bruce in the last 5-6 years, and what a wonderful colleague we have here. So just a background, Bruce received his B.S. in entomology at Louisiana State, Ph.D. in entomology from UC Berkeley. His titles are extensive. Distinguished professor of entomology here, joint appointment with the UC Davis Cancer Center's director, UC Davis Superfund Program Director, NIH Biotechnology Training Program Director. He's the UC Davis Faculty Research Awardee, Lecture Awardee, Distinguished Teacher Award for Graduate and Professional Training, and just last year he was way overdue, but anyway, ESA fellow. So his public, I pulled this off his web, it's just incredible. His laboratory's produced well over 650 publications, 30 patents, 65 graduates, over 300 postdoctoral visiting scientists and scholars, and two companies have spawned from his lab there. You know, he was elected in 1999 to the National Academy. I thought this would be an opportunity just so we know just a little bit about that, how elite this group is. You know, this is one of the highest honors, of course, that any scientist can receive. There's a membership of 2,100 members and 31 different sections. And so his section was that he was elected to in 99 was animal, nutritional, and applied microbial sciences. So the citation reads, you can look this up on the NAS website, Hammack's research to detect toxins in food, the environment, and human tissues using immunocytochemistry revolutionized environmental toxicology and set the present standard for approval of pesticides and products of biotechnology. And by the way, when this is judged on only 12 publications, so that he probably had maybe 450 at that time, but anyway, you pick 12 of the best or that are representative, and they don't care about the numbers, they care about the quality. So this is judged clearly on, you know, of the 12 really high quality publications. Why do they choose members so carefully? First, each member should serve as a role model for defining excellence in science for the next generation. Certainly, Bruce fulfills that role in a really important way. And of course, secondly, the Academy supports this public service of the National Research Council. This is the operating arm of NAS, and it provides policy so that he helps set national policy here. So anyway, his title today of his talk is Moths to Medicine, Epoxide Hydrolase Inhibitors as Analgesic, that is painkillers, agents for neuropathic inflammatory pain. Please join me in welcoming Bruce Hammack.
Anyway, what I thought I'd do is to tell you what goes on down in the basement when we're not underwater. And also to tell a story of butterflies to blood pressure. So if there's a real theme to this talk, it's that it's very hard to see where science is going to go. And it's gone in a lot of different directions. But this project started when I was a beginning graduate student and only about this high, and it's evolved a long way. But I'm also going to give a little bit of background about some of the stuff going on in the lab. So down in the basement, we have three major projects. There's an analytical group that I'm not going to talk about very much. I'll be talking about epoxide hydrolases in mammals. So this is where most of the people in the basement are now working. But I'm, of course, an arthropod biologist at heart. And this work started with insect developmental biology a long time ago. So I really like how caterpillars turn into butterflies, or metamorphosis in insects. And you know, of course, the really magical thing that I've been wondering about my whole life is how do we go from this eating machine to a reproduction distribution machine? And this process is under the control of a number of hormones, but juvenile hormone is one of the major ones. And many years ago, with Sergi Gill, we were looking at the metabolism of juvenile hormone, which is degraded by an epoxide hydrolase to a diol and an esterase to an acid. Both of these are biologically active. Now from this, a couple of things branched out, I'm going to talk very briefly about some insect control applications in one. But the major thing that came up from this is it illustrated that a very potent chemical mediator, in this case juvenile hormone, could be regulated as much by degradation as by biosynthesis. Of course, we have to ask, can the same thing occur in mouse? The other thing is finding this really interesting enzyme that takes an epoxide, a three-membered cyclic ether, to a 1,2 diol. And does that occur in you, or just in insects? And the answer is yes, it occurs in us. So with juvenile hormone, if we inhibit the degradation of juvenile hormone, we get these massive larvae, these, you know, 20-gram hot dogs. They can eat a whole tomato plant at one setting. Now, this didn't really impress the dean very much, and so he suggested that I stop screwing around with pesticides and do something safe. So a number of years ago, in collaboration with Susumu Maeda, Sean Duffy, and a number of people in the lab, including Bora Heiding in the back, we took one of the degrading enzymes from insects, put it into the insect common cold, or baculovirus. When the insect is infected with this virus, it turns into this little black guy, it stops eating, and it tries to pupate. So we were able to generate the first genetically engineered viral insecticide. Actually, though, it turned out something else besides the enzyme worked better, and that these were venoms for one of Boris' pets, a scorpion. So there were very, very potent scorpions, scorpion venoms, that work on mammals. As for instance, we have a collaborative project with Heiko working on some of these in mammals. But George Kamita found that some of them were very selective for insects. So these are data from George Kamita, as I remember. And these are Heliothus larvae. Both have been fed a baculovirus. Both insects will die. But this one, with the wild-type virus, will continue to grow and eat. And this one is contracting because the virus is tricking the insect into making a poison, essentially a biochemical pyrethroid insecticide. And what this does is it doesn't increase the amount of kill, but it increases the speed of kill. So the recombinant virus kills the insects very quickly before they can do crop damage. And you can see this in cotton leaves, where the wild-type virus ultimately kills the larva, but after it's done a lot of damage. We can also see it on whole cotton plants, where the damage here is dramatically reduced compared to the wild-type. However, we ran into problems, more economic than anything else in the US. These viruses are used in China, but they're not used in the US. So we're back to juvenile hormone degradation, epoxide hydrolase, and asking, does the enzyme occur in mammals? The answer is yes. So you have several epoxide hydrolases that convert cyclic epoxides into 1,2 diols. It also converts some compounds that are very mutagenic and carcinogenic. I'm sure nobody in here eats peanut butter or pistachio ice cream, but if you did, you would form highly toxic epoxides, and you don't get cancer because you convert them to diols. So this enzyme occurs in many tissues, and there are two major forms in us. One form, the microsomal hydrolase, grinds up the epoxides in peanut butter and diesel exhaust. The other epoxide hydrolase we found with Sergi Gill. And this talk is going to be a translational talk. The National Institutes of Health wants us to translate everything we do into something that helps people. Well, this is a translational talk, and the work started in 1969, and we're translating it to the clinic. Well, it only took from Christmas to Thanksgiving to do it, but it was Christmas 69 versus getting it into the clinic and Thanksgiving of 2007. So translation from fundamental to applied isn't so fast. Now, these little lists up here are color-coded. You can't read them. I can't even read them. But the key is the work started with practical science way back here, making juvenile hormone mimics, some of which are still in Davis Lumber. And I made the compound that we used for these studies just before Christmas in 1969. But then we have, 30 years of fundamental curiosity-driven research before we start getting back to biomedical research or applied research. And if there's a bottom line to this, it's that it's fairly easy to tell the difference between dumb science and good science, and boring science and exciting science. But probably the most fundamental science, or the most applied science we do, is fundamental work. That we're going to find the transistor not by improving the vacuum tube, but by just trying things because we're interested. And this is a case where we've gone from a very fundamental question, what makes caterpillars turn into butterflies, to materials that are actually in the clinic. So these epoxide hydrolases are at high levels in mammals, including you. They occur at high levels in the liver, which would suggest foreign compound metabolism. But if we move outside the liver, they're at very high levels, for instance, in your vascular smooth muscle. They're very high levels in the astrocytes in your brain. They're very high levels in the ascending loop of Hennel in your kidney. That suggests intermediary and regulatory metabolism. It doesn't suggest foreign compound metabolism. And so even in the 70s, Sergey Gill and I developed the hypothesis that these compounds were involved in regulating endogenous chemical mediators in mammals, just like they are in insects. So the enzyme, this is an X-ray picture of the enzyme. Biochemists get really excited over this because we like pictures of what we do, and they're very pretty. But the enzyme is a homodimer. That means two parts. This is one monomer, this is the other. And it comes with a green part and a blue part. And when we first cloned the enzyme years ago, Jeff Beetham, who was in the lab here, said that if Darwin hadn't invented evolution, we would have had to have invented evolution, because the evolution of the enzyme turns out to be just incredibly interesting. But the epoxide hydrolase end is here. It's an alpha-beta fold enzyme, like cholinesterase in us, or like the enzymes in your laundry detergent that clean your clothes. The alpha-beta fold enzymes are a very broad family of enzymes, all of which have the same structure. They do a whole bunch of different things. And in this case, it does epoxide hydration. So this is a picture that is only semi-science fiction. And that is that this is an X-ray crystal structure. You're inside the enzyme looking out towards water here and here. And the enzyme was crystallized with an inhibitor. And we modeled out the inhibitor and modeled in what we think is a natural substrate. So the catalytic site is this long, greasy tube that goes deep within the enzyme. The catalytic site has a couple of tyrosines that polarize the epoxide, a nucleophilic aspartic acid that attacks it. Most people think acids are not nucleophiles, but in a lipophilic environment they are. And the enzyme works to open the epoxide, and we think the endogenous substrate is an epoxide of a fat. So we often don't think of fats as chemical mediators, but in fact, pregnancy, blood pressure, pain are all controlled by biologically active fat in us. So if we look at how the enzyme works, we can figure out a transition state inhibitor to inhibit it. I'm not really going to go into it, but our inhibitors, which I'll be talking about, fit very tightly within the enzyme, sort of like O.J. Simpson's hand inside of a glove. So it's very, very tight. And something that's really fun is, in the year that I was born, Uncle Linus Pauling came up with an idea that absolutely revolutionized biochemistry called transition state theory. He didn't think much of it. He published it in a couple of junk journals that have zero impact. But the concept was that every catalyst is working by stabilizing transition states. And he actually did it with just Mickey Mouse algebra. And he said that every reaction has a transition state that keeps it from going spontaneously. Every catalyst stabilizes the transition state. The only way to stabilize the transition is to bind to it. And then he calculated how tightly it binds. And it's really tight. But instead of talking about this from the standpoint of algebra, I'm going to use one of my favorite places. So this is south of Mammoth on the east side of the Sierra, and I'll be talking about right there. This is where the east arete of Mount Humphreys joins the north arete of Mount Humphreys. So if we go there and we follow this rope goes up to number one summit. So my son is climbing. It's a mellow fall day. The rock is warm. The rock's hard. Nothing's loose. He's not hanging on very tight. But he's going to climb another 75 feet, and he's going to get right here. That's an overhang. So he's going to have to climb out under this overhang. And as he does this, he can look 7,000 vertical feet down to Bishop, California. Now, that's an unstable transition state. And when Tom is in this transition state, he's hanging on for dear life because he knows that I'm on the other end of the rope and I'm not a very good belayer. So when climbers are in unstable transitions, really weird things happen to them. Similarly, substrates and products in unstable transitions can be modified. You can do magic in these unstable transitions. So by mimicking the transition state of the enzyme, you can sit at your desk and you can intellectually design a powerful inhibitor of an enzyme. And our most potent drugs and pesticides are transition state inhibitors. So when we made these, we made some that were really terrible, but we finally came up with some that had a little bit of friendliness as far as biologists. And since this is Davis, you know, we're not doing complex chemistry. The business end of the molecule is urea. You can get that by stimulating urine production with beer. You can then add a little Crisco at this end. This is for Angela, since she's really into fat. And because we might treat somebody important like our ex-governor, we put this world's smallest diamond out here. So this is a compound that, if you're a chemist, you look at this and you see it's a nightmare compound. It has the physical properties of asphalt. But it was good enough that we were able to then do a chemical knockout and ask, what is the biology of this enzyme inside of a mouse? So we had found a drug, and all we needed was a disease to fit the drug. And so that's going to be the rest of the talk. It turns out that a fat called arachidonic acid is a key chemical mediator in us. This pathway, the arachidonic cascade, accounts for 75% of the medications used in the world. This pathway, the prostaglandins, that's aspirin, Advil, Motrin, controls childbirth, it controls blood pressure, it controls pain. If you feel terrible with the flu, it's because high levels of prostaglandins are busily killing the bacteria, but also killing you a little bit as well. There's another pathway to the leukotrienes. You can think of this pathway as asthma. This is why you don't give aspirin to a baby. But there are two other pathways that are poorly studied, but they count for about a third of the cascade. One of them goes to epoxides, so we're back to epoxides. These compounds are called EETs, or EETs. Another will stick a hydroxy group on the end of the molecule. So these cytochrome P450s are operating in you right now, and they're operating in a balance, switching back and forth between these two pathways. 20-HETE is one of the most hypertensive and inflammatory compounds known. It's making your blood pressure go up. It's making inflammation go up. EETs make hypertension, blood pressure, and pain go down. Now, because these biologies are useful, we have a balance. But it turns out if you get chubby, this pathway predominates. If you're a lounge lizard, this pathway predominates. Unfortunately for me, if you do nothing but get old, this pathway predominates. So we'd like to turn up this one, but we don't know how. But what we do know how to do is to kill this enzyme. If we kill the enzyme that degrades the EETs, then we have an increase in EETs and a decrease in blood pressure, inflammation, and pain. In most cases, that's a good thing. So the first indication we really found was were on cardiovascular disease. So I'm going to go through this very quickly and then move on to things that are new and more exciting and unpublished. But if we take a cross-section of your blood vessel, you have a vascular endothelium. This is the lining of your blood vessel. And we have the vascular smooth muscle controlling the diameter of the blood vessel. If your blood vessel contracts, blood flow is restricted, blood pressure goes up. There was a Nobel Prize for NO right here on how the vascular endothelium tells the vascular smooth muscle to relax or constrict. And this is NO, laughing gas. But when they got the Nobel Prize, they said there's another factor. It turns out that that other factor, called the endothelium-derived hyperpolarizing factor, are the EATs, the epoxy eicosanoids. They're produced by the vascular endothelium telling the vascular smooth muscle to relax and reduce blood pressure. So Christoph Morisseau, and I ran this over in Everson Hall originally, but it was repeated in Germany by Rudy Busi's group in a very elegant experiment. So we're looking at blood pressure as a function of time in mice. Right here, we put in a little pump that dispenses angiotensin, which Arzu is now doing in the lab. This changes the poor little mouse into a 50-year-old plus man, and blood pressure skyrockets. So this is most male hypertension is angiotensin driven. If we give an EH inhibitor, blood pressure doesn't go up as much. Here what's done is really complex experiment. The water bottles are shifted. When these animals are taken off of the drug, blood pressure skyrockets. When these animals are put on the drug, blood pressure drops. Other thing that's really unique about these compounds is that they're homeostatic. So no matter how much of the drug we give to a control animal, we don't change the blood pressure. So we can reduce high blood pressure, but we don't drop normal blood pressure. So the compounds move us back to homeostasis. SEHs are also a potential target for treating inflammation. We've used one indication called sepsis. This is a very hard thing to treat. Most of us in this room will die of sepsis. But we are mainly using it not so much from a treatment standpoint as a model of inflammation. We're also using a technique called metabolomics, where we basically take a mouse or a baby and shove it into a mass spec. This is what goes on in Everson Hall. And it pulls them apart and asks what's there. So we're using mass spectrometry to ask what are the eicosanoids in the blood of a mouse or a man. So this is a small part of the arachidonic cascade. Here's arachidonic acid, and it basically says arachidonic acid can go to many, many metabolites, and each of these are biologically important. And what we're able to do with mass spectrometry is not just look at a single compound like prostaglandin, but look at a pattern and begin to see what is the biology that's being driven and how is it being driven. So there's a lot of analytical chemistry involved in this. So the sepsis experiment is we give mice lipopolysaccharide, that's the outside of bacteria. Regardless of how we give it, all the mice die. If we give an EH inhibitor, none of the mice die. So this is, an experiment even a microbiologist can interpret. So if the mice have their feet facing down, they're alive. They're like this, they're not alive. And so we have this binary system for telling how the mice are. They die of acute hypotension, low blood pressure. The drugs will increase blood pressure back to normal. So that's the biology. If we look now at the eicosanoid profile, these are the arachidonic metabolites we're looking at by mass spec. We find in yellow, if the animals are given LPS, the epoxides go down. We expect that. If we give the EH inhibitor, shown in blue, they go up. We expect that. The diols do just the opposite of the products. The product diols go up. If we give the inhibitors, blue dials go down. We expect that. Now you notice these are linear graphs, arithmetic. But this is a log graph. Here we're monitoring prostaglandin E2. This is the major prostaglandin that is the driver when you get the flu. It's pain, it's fever, it's inflammation. If we give LPS, prostaglandin goes up 1,000-fold. You feel really terrible with the flu. If we give the EH inhibitors, it's reduced. Prostaglandins are on this side of the arachidonic cascade. The epoxide hydrolase inhibitors are working on this side. So how's that working? It turns out that these epoxy eicosanoids transcriptionally downregulate COX-2. This is where Vioxx, Celebrex work to reduce this inflammatory enzyme and a number of other inflammatory enzymes and cytokines. So the EATs are reducing inflammation at the transcriptional level, the level of messenger RNA. So if we have LPS, prostaglandins go up. If we give Celebrex, they go down. We give a low dose of Celebrex, they don't go down. If we give an SEH inhibitor, they go down. If we combine an SEH inhibitor with Celebrex, or Proxen, or Advil, we get a synergistic interaction. So these compounds are very anti-inflammatory. A lot of the diseases we face as humans are inflammatory disease. This is work by Nipsia Movat in the medical school, where she's looking at cardiac hypertrophy, big hearts, in a number of different models. She can create this massive hypertrophy. If we give epoxide hydrolase inhibitors, we can reduce heart size back to normal and can do it either prophylactically or therapeutically. Right now, there is no therapy for cardiac hypertrophy. So this is a very exciting result. These are data from our zoo. These are our mice fed McDonald's hamburgers. This is the aortic arch. You get a huge buildup of lipid. If we give the EH inhibitor, the aortic arch is more or less clear of lipid. So vascular inflammation is a major driver, particularly in the postprandial state, of inflammation. So the EH inhibitors that we have in the lab are more potent than the common nonsteroidal inflammatories in aspirin and the COX-IBs like Vioxx and Celebrex. I'm not getting into this, but Jun Yan and others in the lab have also shown that the EH inhibitors will reduce the toxicity of these commonly used drugs. So these drugs all increase thrombic risk and GI problems. So I'm going to go first very briefly into drug development. So a major problem that we face is most innovation is occurring in universities. It's really hard to develop a drug in a university. Industry seems to be crippled in developing new drugs, but they have the resources to develop. So how do we get from the ideas in the university to translation to industry? And there's a real problem because industry wants you to be quite far along this path, but NSF, NIH only fund early stage research. So what we've been doing under the table in the lab is trying to convert this idea into a practical drug. Now, there are a lot of sophisticated ways to do chemistry, but we do Goldilocks chemistry. Or Goldilocks medicinal chemistry. So basically, we make a compound. If we find that it's too big, we make a little one. If we find it's too little, we make a middle-sized one. Or if it's too hot, we make a cool one. Or too cool, we make a warm one. And this way, several of us in the lab, including Singh and Sung-hee, wander through chemical space trying to make better and better compounds. We look at the potency of the compound, but we also look at the pharmacokinetics. So here the compounds were given to dogs by Cindy Tai, and our early compounds didn't get in very well, and when they did, they were very quickly metabolized. So this is looking at blood levels. Other compounds were able to get in, but were quickly metabolized. But now increasingly we have compounds that are very potent on the recombinant human enzyme, but when we feed them to dogs or mice or rats or monkeys, they get in and give reasonable blood levels. So what we've done is to not try to play like a little Fison, but to in fact use what I call the MedChem sorting hat, analogous to the Harry Potter sorting hat. So what we can say is, in academics, we're good at some things. We're good at being cheap and we're good at being fast. And so we do that work in drug development that is fast and cheap. We can screen potency with a robot very, very quickly. We can look at physical properties in computer modeling because that's not very expensive. That's inside a computer. We can do inexpensive talks like the Ames essay, and we've worked out ways to do pharmacokinetics, which is the great limiting step in drug development. And by doing this, we've come up with compounds that are pretty good. So looking through the years, what we've done is made compounds that have better exposure and better efficacy. So we monitor efficacy using the cloned human enzyme and saying how potent is the compound. And that's the denominator. And then in this case, Cindy fed these compounds to monkeys and looked at blood levels. That's area under the blood curve or exposure. By looking at this ratio through time, we've come up with better and better compounds that look more and more drug-like. And this is what we're trying to actually take into the clinic. A pharmaceutical company got the compounds from the patents from UC and took actually a compound published by our lab into the clinic. Unfortunately, it was neither potent nor very good. So as a summary then, what we're trying to do is we know that arachidonic acid is a major chemical mediator. It can go to prostaglandins, it can go to HETEs, but it also can go to these epoxides. By stabilizing these epoxides, by inhibiting the epoxide hydrolyze, we reduce pain, hypertension, and inflammation. So what I'm getting into then is work that Karen and Moore have done in the basement that is new work. And that is that if these compounds work on inflammation, like aspirin, we would expect them to be a little bit analgesic. But if we give a number of different compounds at a number of different doses to rats, we don't change at all their ability to perceive pain. Well, that's kind of a good thing, right? You don't want pain to completely go away. On the other hand, if an animal has an enhanced pain state, so in this case, pain is in this direction. In all the slides, an accentuated pain state is in red, and normal pain perception is in green. So if you think about getting the flu, you'll notice that if your shirt sleeve rubs on your arm, or your pants rub on your leg, that really hurt. That's called allodynia. Or if you stub your toe, that's a minor pain, but it's just unbearable if you have the flu. That's hyperalgesia. So what we're doing is in rats is monitoring enhanced pain, either allodynia or hyperalgesia, and then asking with increased doses of EH inhibitors, can we return this back to normal? And the answer is yes. Using a number of different inflammatory agents, we can return it back to normal. Not only do we do it in normal pain, if we induce pain with prostaglandin E2, this is that prostaglandin that is produced when you get sick, you get a tremendous enhancement in pain. But if you take an aspirin, if you take a Celebrex, if you take an Advil, it doesn't do any good. Even if you take a steroid like dexamethasone, you can't reverse this pain. But the EH inhibitors can reduce prostaglandin-induced pain, which is a very good thing. So the EH inhibitors are far more potent than morphine. Morphine can reduce pain, but so can these SEH inhibitors. And the numbers look about the same, except that one is 10 nanograms and one is 10 micrograms. So these are very, very powerful compounds. But compounds like morphine have another problem, and that is they block gut mobility and that cause sedation. The EH inhibitors seem to not reduce coordination and not reduce alertness in animals, although whether they're addictive remains to be seen. Now, my main job in the basement is hustling money, but occasionally I come up with a brilliant idea. So I suggested to Bora a number of years ago that, having tried a number of pain models, he try neuropathic pain, because nothing works on neuropathic pain. And I expected us to fail and thus be able to say, well, our compounds work on this pain but not this pain, therefore we're credible. But we're clearly not credible. The surprise is the compounds work really well on intractable neuropathic pain. So you can get neuropathic pain in many ways. If you get in a car accident and you have a damaged nerve, you can get neuropathic pain. The one that now probably half the people in this room at some time will face is that in diabetes, severe neuropathic pain is a major comorbidity. So a lot of the work that Bora and Karen have done is with a type 1 diabetes model. So as type 1 diabetes progresses, the high levels of sugar cause nerve dieback and neuropathic pain. So if we look at the allodynia from type 1 diabetes-induced pain, so this would be a normal animal, a diabetic animal, we can reverse that pain in a dose-dependent fashion with EH inhibitors. If we compare this to the major industry standard used for neuropathic pain, gabapentin, the EH inhibitors are about 10 times more potent in this figure. Not only that, the gabapentin needs to be given every 24 hours with some fairly severe side effects, and with time, the efficacy of the gabapentin will drop. The EH inhibitor used in this study reverses pain with a single dose of about 72 hours. The other thing that I find really interesting is the most common drug prescribed for neuropathic pain are nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories and coxibs, and they don't work. They never work. They often, in fact, will make pain worse. So diclofenac is the major nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory used in the world. It actually will make the diabetic pain worse. But if we combine SEH inhibitor at a low dose with diclofenac, we get a synergistic reduction in neuropathic pain. So we're really excited about this, because this is an unmet medical need where it looks like that either used alone or used in combination with nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories and coxibs, that these might be able to treat a previously untreatable condition. So in this model, if we look at the EH inhibitor, this is a streptozocin diabetes 1 model, we can reduce pain. So we get a little bit of hyperalgesia. That's reducing pain beyond the point where it's not there. Morphine can also do the same thing in this model. But with morphine, we get sedation and a loss of coordination. And this is the problem faced by people with neuropathic pain. The drugs that work have such devastating side effects that it's a real trade-off. So, do these compounds offer a risk to you? Well, I don't know. Hopefully we'll find out. But you're all taking them. That if you use Dial soap, and wish everybody else did, as the commercial says, you may have 80 nanograms per mil of this quite potent EH inhibitor in your blood. If you don't use Dial soap, you probably still have about 5 nanograms per mil, because the compound goes right through sewage treatment, and these personal care products are pretty pervasive in the environment. But at any rate, these compounds will in fact reduce pain and are powerful EH inhibitors. So the story that I've told you probably has a little bit of truth to it. It started a long time ago, when I was very, very small and very, very young in graduate school, working with Sergeant Gill. We were working on a chemical mediator in insects and asking how this chemical mediator regulates larval pupil transformation. in doing this, we found that not only the production of the compound was important, but also its degradation by epoxide hydrolases and esterases. So this work led in a whole bunch of direction. One is to juvenoids. And last week, we celebrated Clive Hedrick, years ago, finding JH mimics that, in fact, are still the mainstay of mosquito control in California based on this molecule. But there are molecules in us that also have epoxides and esters. By looking at this end of the molecule in insects, we've had a pretty good time with genetically engineered viral pesticides. In mammals, this is where DAG lipase, PLA2, an enzyme called FAWR, well, this is how marijuana works at this end of the molecule. So the juvenile hormone has been a really interesting molecule at this end. But at this end, it's led to studying epoxide hydrolases. So epoxide hydrolases are not only important in insect chemical ecology, metabolizing pheromones, metabolizing endogenous plant compounds, but also in regulating this potent chemical mediator, juvenile hormone in insects, and this very potent chemical mediator, epoxyacosatriaenoic acids in us. So, if there is a grand overview of what we've been trying to do, it's to avoid medicine as usual. So medicine as usual is playing a piano like I play a piano. I do the one finger piano play. So you go to a doctor and you say, I've got a headache. The doctor pushes one key and says, aspirin, go away, take two. You go to the doctor and you say, well, my knee hurts. The doctor uses the other finger, pushes on the piano key, says, Celebrex, go away, take like two a day, don't bother me. But potentially what we can do is by understanding metabolomics and individualizing medicine, we could say, well, if you take a very low dose of Celebrex, a very low dose of SEH, you'll get a synergistic interaction and your knee will feel a lot better without all the side effects. But maybe, Angela, we can even do better. And that is that we could dial in nutraceuticals. Maybe if we're increasing our omega-3 lipids, whose epoxides, borax found, are even more active than the arachidonase, that we could alter our diet, potentially use pharmaceuticals if we need them, alter our lifestyle, because if you go jogging, it turns out the eats in your blood go way up, and alter our diet. Begin to play the piano with one hand instead of one finger, or maybe even use metabolomics so that we can individualize diagnosis and treatment and begin to deliver individualized and integrated medicine. Of course, this is the next five generations, and I'm bringing it up hoping that some of you will address problems like this. And have an eicosanoid symphony, where we begin to understand how the eicosanoids really work and the complexity of how the eicosanoids and the cytokines talk with each other to control our biology. So I wanted to show pictures of several people in the lab. Singh and Sung Hee have done the chemistry work recently. Karen and Bora doing the pain work. But the project is, of course, much beyond this, with collaborators around the world and a whole bunch of really wonderful, exciting colleagues in the basement who continue to try to teach me biology and chemistry. And then, this is Kathy's favorite picture of our water balloon fight. I wanted to end with two things. One is that I teach kayaking through outdoor adventures, so I'm always looking for victims. The water this year is really high, and it's really cold and really exciting. And since a lot of you here are grad students, science is serious, that's the number one priority, but you are at a university. So take the time to go to classes in literature, maybe classes in history, and maybe pottery, but also maybe outdoor adventures. And that's my favorite mountain, Bear Creek Spire, and this was a lab trip to Bear Creek Spire from several years ago. And I'll end there and see if you guys have questions.
Drugs, the issue of toxicity, the issue of addiction is an important one.
Yep.
So have you looked into?
We haven't looked at a ditch in Yelma. We have, the people in the field will often separate dependence from addiction. So if you have a pinched nerve, you may be very, very dependent on a drug, that you would do almost anything for it. You probably wouldn't kill your mother. And that's basically the difference between addiction and dependence. Since we don't see clear hallucination, we don't see sedation, and we don't see lack of coordination, we think that the effects will probably not lead to addiction. But you never know until you get into humans. And in fact, we may find that we simply have mouse, rat, and dog drugs, and we don't have human drugs. As far as toxicity, the company that took one compound into the clinic failed to find any toxicity. On the toxicity screens that we've done, I've never seen a profile as clean as these as a toxicologist. But there's always a caution in science, and that's that, you know, we test hypotheses, we never prove anything. We cannot prove a compound safe. We can only show that it's not safe. So with thalidomide, you know, an incredible disaster in Europe, in reality, you could not look for birth defects until you knew to look for birth defects. So until the compound has gone through the pre-IND work, we don't know. What we have done is we've applied to the NIH RAID program. We're trying to get what's called an IND. This is investigational new drug status. So the compound can be used in man, and we're trying to do this in the public sector so that physicians in Toronto or New York could use it in clinical trials. Jeff?
How do you test for, the technical question, and then another one, but how do you test for pain in rodents?
So there are a number of different ways, but the basis of what we do is allodynian hyperalgesia. So I'm really worried about causing pain in animals. You know, it really is terrible to be a captive rodent and have pain inflicted. But we're looking at allodynia and hyperalgesia. So this is the enhanced pain state that you would get, for instance, if you had the flu. So we use, for mechanical stimulation, we use something called the von Frey fiber, which is the same thing a doctor would use. The rat is standing on a mesh, and his foot is basically tickled with a computer-controlled fiber of different strings. And when the rat says that tickles and lifts its foot, that's one indication. The other is we put the rat on a glass plate. And by the way, the fiber is the same thing you would do on yourself.
But that's not pain.
It's not pain, but it's an indication of pain. So this hyperalgesia model has been associated with pain. But ultimately, we don't know until it's in that. With the other is we put them on a plate where a laser shines on their foot, and then a computer says, well, when do they lift their foot? And so when you put your hand on this plate, you begin to feel it very slightly warm. And so that's our other model. But then we're inducing the allodynian hyperalgesia in a number of different ways. But you're bringing up a really important point, and that is that pain has a social context, an emotional context, physiological context. And so it's very, very difficult to extrapolate from rodents to man.
Do mice die of, or is hypertension a risk factor in mice?
You can generate hypertension to the point that the mouse will
die. So have you tried your compounds? Do they live longer? Do you have some have hypertension and others that don't? And is your assay just for short term, or is it a lifetime?
Our assays are short term. So by short term, say with what Arzu is doing, we're limited by the length of the mini pump that releases angiotensin. Well, you can release angiotensin forever until you're dead. So we're looking at a period of weeks. We have another model where we place the human renin enzyme under the blue gene promoter. So if we feed the rats blue genes, then this will induce human renin, and the renin will make angiotensin. So this can be a very long term, but the longest term studies that we've done on hypertension have been 6 months.
insects in general have gain in information pathways of any kind?
They certainly have information. So years ago in an insect physiology book, I read that insects didn't have an immune system. Now this is just nuts. Any creature that doesn't have an immune system yet, a pine tree has an immune system. And really what that book should have said is that insects seem to have an immune system that's very different from ours. And that probably would have been correct in 1960. But now we know that although insects don't have IgG, they have a cellular immune system that is remarkably similar to ours. They have an inflammatory system, and they are specialized. They're doing the same things we are in very different ways, but there's some things they do that are just absolutely identical to us. Same protein, same system, and now they have an immune system. And, you know, as far as pain, we don't really know. In fact, I'm not even sure you have a pain sensation. I know I have one. It's very hard to put ourselves at the level, say, of paramecium. And yet, paramecium will have avoidance response, which one can improve.
And are epoxides involved with something that might be interpreted as pain?
We have not found, in insects, there are only a handful of cases where we've seen the arachidonic cascade involved in this. Pressure reduction is one. So it doesn't appear to be nearly as important to us. But I think if we look hard, we're going to find something like it. For instance, in nematodes, they have exactly the same enzymes. U450s have the epoxide hydrolysis. But when I went to Australia and spent months dumping arachidonic derivatives on nematodes, I got no biology. It turns out they use a shorter chain fatty acid, 18-2, to do about the same thing we're doing with higher money part. So I bet it's going to be, we're going to see both analogy and homology.
So I think we better call that a day here.
Thanks.
So thanks very much, Bruce. Yeah.